This week on the Pre-Health Podcast at Penn State, we are going to welcome you into the future of science and medicine. This week we're discussing Neuralink, which is a very new technology that we're still exploring, but it's bringing up a lot of questions about data, our brains, technology, what is humanity? So we're going to unpack that, talk about it, and explore what it means to step into this new age of humanity. Thanks for joining us for another week. Hello, and welcome back to the Pre-Health Podcast at Penn State, the show to help all pre-health students on their journeys to acceptance. My name is John Moses Bronson. I am this week's host. My lovely co-host, Kimberly Johnson, continues to be out with her gorgeous, beautiful, amazing new baby. And so everything is going well. Baby is healthy. Mom is loving baby. Older brother is starting to warm up to little brother. So things are going pretty well at this time. But so she'll be back in a few weeks. And so pretty excited to welcome her back at that point. But today I'm very excited that we are welcoming a new guest within our ethics series. So you all know Dr. Michelle Meckel quite well. That lucky duck is abroad and she is traveling. We're so thrilled for her. But thankfully, she connected us to a friend and colleague of hers. And so I'm so excited to welcome you today. Dr. Cabrera, can you say hello to our wonderful listening audience?
Hello, everyone. Hope you're having a good day.
So because the audience sort of knows Dr. Meckel, they know her background. If you could just talk to me a little bit about your background, where you're from, where you went to school, what you studied, how you came to be studying this bizarre future science wildness.
Sure. So I am from Mexico.
Okay.
I think where our colleague Michelle is currently. And I studied there electrical and communication engineering.
Oh, cool.
So I have an engineering background. But soon after I finished my degree, I found myself with all of these questions about, we do all this great work, but we don't often stop and think about the impacts and implications of the technology that we develop. Mm. So that really moved me to pursue a master and a PhD in applied ethics.
Oh, interesting.
And that's what I did. I was focused on nanotechnology, nanoethics mm-hmm. issues. And then through an opportunity, I have to attend a boot camp on neuroscience for non-neuroscientists that really hooked me into the field of neuro. And ever since I've done neuroethics.
Very cool. So how did you get connected to that boot camp thing? Where was it at?
It actually was close by. It was at the University of Pennsylvania.
Okay.
They had for a while some funds to run this bootcamp. Okay. I think right now it's been quiet. Mm-hmm. But for a couple of years, this was something that they would do yearly. Mm-hmm. And they would bring up to a cohort of, I want to say, 20 people that were non-neuroscientists to just be immersed and learn about neuroscience.
Very, very interesting. So what brought you to Penn State? How did you end up here, of all places?
Yeah, so I've been very lucky because really I've been in so many countries, right? I did my master in Sweden, PhD in Australia, one of my first postdoc in Switzerland. Then I was in Vancouver doing a second postdoc. And I go to the U.S. through my first faculty position, which was at Michigan State.
Okay.
And I was at the time at the College of Human Medicine.
Okay.
But having an engineer background, I felt that's a place where I really wanted to contribute.
Yeah.
Even though I had collaborators that are physicians mm-hmm. and things like that. But so when this opportunity came about to be an associate professor here at Penn State in the College of Engineering doing neuroethics, it was something I had to take.
Yeah. So are you in the engineering science and mechanics department?
Yes.
I have so many friends in that department. I used to work in engineering. That was my first job at University Park, was I was over in engineering. Mm-hmm. And so I know Chris Masters really well. Mm-hmm. I know Lucas Passmore very well. Lovely human beings. Lucas is a wild person, but so wonderful. So I love engineering science, and our listeners aren't going to know a lot about it, but I think it's such a cool major. It's like depressingly underdone by students because there's so many cool opportunities. But I sort of want to I wanted to put that out there just because I'm like, I really love where you're at, and I think it is such a cool department. But I want to sort of zero in a little bit more on how we got brought together today. Mm-hmm. So a few months ago, when I was talking with Dr. Meckel about, you know, what are the big questions in science and healthcare and medicine right now? And one of the first things that she brought up was Neuralink. And I was like, I don't know what that is. Mm-hmm. And then when she explained it, I was like, that's terrifying. So for our listeners that might not know what that term means, can you deconstruct a little bit what exactly Neuralink is?
Yes. So Neuralink is a company co-founded by Elon Musk. Mm-hmm. It's a company that focuses on developing a brain-computer interface, mm-hmm. which the current version is called the Link. Mm-hmm. And so basically their effort is to develop a brain-computer interface that would allow individuals to, you know, for example, the first case is to allow individuals with paraplegia or that kind of move to be able to re-engage and communicate in some form back to the world. So let me step back a little bit and explain what a brain-computer interface is. And yeah. I'll be using the shorthand BCI because that's
much faster.
The is much faster. So a BCI is basically is a system. It could be implantable, like in the case of the Link, that's an implantable BCI, mm-hmm. but there are also non-implantable ones or external ones. The core aspect of a BCI is that it connects the brain to another interface, right? Like an external interface. It could be a computer, it could be a robotic arm, but it connects the brain to the outer world.
Okay. Interesting. So I remember back in my time in engineering that I had a lot of students that are thinking about what, you know, the future of prosthetics can look like, right? And so, you know, a lot of like our prosthetic limbs right now are more sort of like static limbs, but they're like, what if we can build a hand that has the range of motion that our organic hands have? I was like, whoa, wow, okay. Well, we'll see that in like the year 3000. Mm-hmm. And now I'm not sure that it's that far away.
Yeah, no, you're right. I think so Dr. Meckel and I, we have this class on science fiction and ethics, right?
Yeah.
And we really kind of joke about it, you know, what was science fiction, now is science fact.
Yeah.
And this is an area that has gotten a lot of traction.
Yeah.
Here in the U.S., especially through the Brain Initiative. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of funds, now a lot of private investors. And so we're seeing a lot of, you know, really cool advances, but also advances that make us pause and think, all right, having a brain, an implant in my brain, you know, it has implications. So let's stop for a little bit and think about what are those.
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit about how this actually works? Because I'm just like, I'm thinking of like cartoons, right? Because that's like my reference point of like where I've seen this in pop culture. And there's sort of like the trope of like a little microchip that they just place on your brain and everything's fine. How does this actually work? Because I don't think it's as simple as putting a little microchip in the brain.
Yeah, no. So, well, one of the innovations of Neuralink in particular, it's that they have a robot that does implantation. And then they say that the benefit of that is that it has less a potential for side effects. I mean, that's still to be, you know, mm-hmm. proven. But so
bold
they have
claim.
Yes. So they have this robot surgeon that makes the implant. So the link, what is also the innovation in the technology is that it has a lot of like little threads.
Okay.
That expand, or once you implant the core of the electrode, you have all of these threads that connect to different parts of the brain. So you can record for a from a large area of neurons. Okay.
So do the threads, like, does the robot sort of like place the threads, or does the thing in the brain just sort of like send them where they're supposed to be?
You see, one of the things that is curious about Neuralink is the lack of transparency. Mm. So we haven't seen, or I personally haven't seen a lot of reports on how this gets done. Like, you know, you just have this robotic surgeon does implantation, and we know that there are threads because we've seen some of the images.
Yeah.
But a lot of the details are really unknown to the tech community.
Hmm. Well, it's because, you know, I think about like the big advances in science, and those are always sort of announced and presented in the form of research papers but a lot of that is because it's public money, it's, you know, federal funding. And so there is that expectation and requirement for those things. Because a lot of this sounds like it's mostly private investments, that same sort of like standard and expectation doesn't seem to exist.
Yes, to a large extent, that's completely true. However, there are other players in the BCI world, like BlackRock, Neurotech, you have Synchron. So those are two of the largest companies developing BCIs with a lot of funds.
Mm-hmm.
And they have tended to be either partnering with academic centers, and even in cases where I think they have followed more like let's be transparent mm-hmm. type of approach. Whereas, this is a speculation from my part, right? Because I think Neuralink having as a co-founder Elon Musk, what I get to see a lot is many X posts, uh-huh. for example, or, you know, just through social media channels, a lot of communication. And so that's not, as you said, like, does not have the same rigor that mm-hmm. we would see in a publication, or even presentations in conferences, at the same level of detail that I've seen with other, you know, developments.
So you kind of like gave a nice little taste of where this could be really relevant for listeners, which is like, well, you know, what are the outcomes? Why are we doing this, right? And one of the biggest ones, which you mentioned, is that like there are some health issues and conditions that can be treated. What are sort of like the major ones that we're thinking, right? Like you talked about paraplegia, and that one was like, okay, yeah, because there's sort of like a shut off between different parts of the nervous system. That makes sense to me. Is there anything else that we're thinking that this has the capacity to help with?
Yeah, I mean, other disorders that BCI companies have been targeting is ALS, for example. I think the current clinical trial with Synchron, that's the population that they're trying to reach.
Okay.
And so ALS, any disorder where really the kind of the motor system kind of collapse in a way so that you cannot really tell your peripheral nervous system, I want to move my arm. And so you lose that ability to connect to the rest of your body. That's one of the first ones that they're targeting.
So I would imagine like Parkinson's, which sort of has these involuntary movements, could be another extension of that.
So, I mean, this is interesting because this is where the field is a little bit, I would say we're already doing that, right?
Okay.
So we have the brain stimulation,
uh-huh.
which is, you know, it's a type of technology, but if you're strict about the terminology of a BCI, DBS is a type of BCI because it's connecting the brain to this interface, right?
Okay.
And especially one of the other things that I did not expand too much is that a brain-computer interface, what really requires is to have this closed loop, right? Where you would want to record from the brain, and then the system then will, you know, process that information and then have an outcome, right? Whether moving a cursor on the screen or translating that to movement of a robotic arm. In the case of deep brain stimulation, the most recent advances, what the closed loop version of it does is that it would measure, you know, regions of the motor cortex, and by processing that information, decide, well, should I should stimulate now or not, instead of just constant stimulation, which was the case a few years ago. So yeah, in a sense, we're really helping people with Parkinson.
Interesting. So, like, my brain is now also thinking, like, for people who have Tourette syndrome or sort of those other sort of cognitive things that they're not actively controlling, are we thinking about how, like, I'm curious as to what this looks like for intrusive thoughts, right? Thoughts that we don't have active control over, because a lot of the applications that we're talking about so far, and I think this is probably just something we don't know yet, right? Mm-hmm. Is that we're talking about, like, how do you move a cursor on a screen, right? If you have loss of limbs, how do you move a robotic arm? How do you sort of destimulate the brain to not have these other movements? But with intrusive thoughts, like, that's an active thought that's happening, right? Oh, man, my brain is just like, how do we clean those thoughts apart? Mm. We can't even do it ourselves.
Mm.
As humans, we can't do that.
So, I mean, this is interesting because it's really, you're just asking about what is the future of BCIs. In deep brain stimulation, there's already, you know, there's a couple of clinical trials that are moving to areas of, you know, depression, obsessive compulsive disorder, anxiety.
Wow.
I mean, the list has really, is large. However, we still haven't, we don't have the evidence that it really helps. So with DBS and Parkinson, that's already approved. It's like we have decades of knowledge we're just kind of improving. Where in psychiatric, for psychiatric disorders, that's still not there. But
I mean, our study of those things in general is very short term, so that's not super shocking.
But what I wanted to come back to Neuralink is that Neuralink has not been shy to say that we're going to start with, you know, paraplegia, quadriplegia, ALS, but then we really want to move to all of these others. And they have like a laundry list of all the things that they say Neuralink could help.
That's a lot. That's a lot of data. And we'll come back to that. What do you think are some of the biggest, like, risks that we are facing as a result of Neuralink? Because it sounds, in a previous episode, we talked about the drug Ozempic and Wegovy or Wegovy, I don't actually know how that one's technically pronounced, but it's like this miracle drug, right? And Neuralink seems like a miracle technology, but miracles always have a dark side. So what are sort of the dark sides that we're thinking about and seeing out there with Neuralink sort of coming on the scene or these sorts of technologies?
Yeah, exactly. I think Neuralink is just one example of many, you know, companies that are actively working on the field. And so some of the risks are, you know, we know from other similar technologies, like, you know, every time you implant something in the brain, there's potential for infection.
Yeah.
There is potential for hemorrhage. You know, once you have something in the brain, they could be like, you know, a lead breaks or part of it breaks. And then what do you do with that? How do you, can you explant or not? And so those are risks from more like the hardware part.
Yeah.
But there are also risks that come from the stimulation part, right? Because what I mentioned a little bit earlier was, you know, you are not just kind of recording, measuring from the brain. You're also looping back and intervening, right? Creating some form of stimulation that you expect will have an outcome, right? And and that stimulation, in the case, for example, of deep brain stimulation, there are cases, this is not, fortunately, this is not something that happens with a lot of patients, but for a couple of patients, what happens is that, you know, they might have changes of, I'm going to call it personality because that's a term that in the literature appears a lot. But for example, you used to be shy and then suddenly you start becoming more like a you know, outgoing, a risk taker. And so there's been a lot of research into what factors might facilitate that someone with DBS might develop these type of things. Because it's not, it, again, it's not super common. Those are rare, but it happens. So it's really interesting to see that, you know, what is going to happen when these new technologies, especially these, you know, high density arrays, like in the case of Neuralink, where you have more channels to measure from,
mm-hmm.
and you are also having more areas connected in the brain. So what does that mean for like what type of risk that we haven't seen might unfold? And I think that's just a matter of like we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, I think for anybody that is in like a neuroscience minor or one of the majors that has a neuroscience option or studies it at all, one of the first things that you learn or know is that we know very little about the brain. And it feels like we are poking a bear of undetermined size. Like this could be a bear cub. This could be like a grizzly bear with like 15 arms. Like I'm worried that we are poking around in something that we just don't know enough about. And what does that mean?
Yeah. But this is what is so interesting, because one of the reasons why I got attracted to the field, I attended a conference where I, for the first time, I heard about deep brain stimulation.
Yeah.
And a patient who showed us videos of how how she was before DBS, and you could see her trembling and she couldn't grab a cup of tea and she couldn't walk. And then I was seeing her there and she was not trembling. Like she was stuck. I was amazed of what we can do.
The power.
Yeah, the power of technology. At the same time, through my research, I know that there are cases where things don't go as planned.
Yeah.
And so how can we, I mean, obviously we want to help people, mm-hmm. but we want to do it in a responsible manner and in a cautious manner because we just don't know enough.
Yeah.
And we don't know if in the long term we're causing more harm than good.
Yeah. I think some of the people that may have heard about Neuralink, I think one of the things that they are worried about is sort of like the oddnesses in the non-human trials.
Mm-hmm.
And so my knowledge of this is relatively limited, but like there wasn't wonderful results in like the simian trials, correct?
Well, I mean, this is like what is kind of hard to assess because they got FDA approval, right?
Yeah, which is not easy. If anybody has ever tried to get anything through the FDA, that is a process.
But, you know, I think, I mean, maybe if people, browse this, you can see videos where there's the classical, monkey playing, I think, Pong that became very popular a few years ago. And so their trials, they show that something was possible, right? Or they were at least, and they were not the first ones that have done this. We have seen other technologies where they have proved similar things. But I think what happened with the animals controversy was that, there were claims that the animals were not treated well and that, they were mishandled.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that was not fully clear when they got the FDA approval.
Got it.
So that's, I think, what makes it really tricky
messy
to assess. Yeah, messy, because you don't, as a, as someone that, taxpayer dollars goes into a lot of research and, these public entities like FDA and all that, then you're thinking, well, you haven't really figured out, or you haven't proved that all these claims are wrong, and then you're giving this company access to people's brains, so... And I mean, they must have had a reason, I want to believe, right? But I think that makes one a little bit more hesitant or at least more cautious.
Yeah.
In a way that I think if they have waited to clear that and then had the approval, that would have been a little bit different.
Okay. One of the other things that sort of strikes me as concerning is our brains are taking in tons of data all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And this interface, you said that like one of the important things is that it's a closed loop system. Is there data being created by that part of the interface that is external to the brain? And what happens to that data? Because I can see from like a machine learning perspective that it like that the interface learning what is going well and what's not going well with what's happening with the individual patient would be useful. But like, Could someone with nefarious intent go in and poke around in that data? And what does that look like?
Yeah, so there's been some literature about, you know, what some of my colleagues call brain hacking, right? So any, you know, technology that is connected to the internet can be, in a sense, hacked, right? You can intervene, like you can do it with computers, you can do it with any other system. So there's been some also research for pacemakers. And so theoretically, you can hack a deep brain-computer interface or a DBS system. We haven't heard cases where that has happened yet, but it's not impossible.
I don't love that not impossible part.
Exactly. And this is the thing. That's why technology comes with trade-offs, right? We want to help people, but like really making this bulletproof would just not make the technology as helpful as it is. So unfortunately, a lot of these patients will have to take that risk, knowing that, you know, they have something that now connects them to, you know, basically to the online world. And that means that if someone has bad intentions, potentially they could, you know, they could mess, not necessarily with the data, but you see, they could, you know, they could change some of the parameters of the algorithm so that, you know, it doesn't go the same way, and that could potentially be harmful, or they could turn it off, or they could, you know, change the parameters. So yeah, fortunately we have not seen people doing this. But we certainly know that cybersecurity is a big topic,
Yeah, and so I feel like the future of this technology sort of almost has to walk hand in hand with the future of cyber technology and cybersecurity. You know, I'm certainly not an expert in either of those areas. In what ways is there protection for the brain, right? Like, because you talked about, you know, we don't know if there's anytime with any surgery, there's the possibility for infection, right? And so are we doing like what we normally do, which is like, hey, if you find symptoms, let's check it. Do we build in those sort of checks into the system itself that like if it detects an infection in and around its area, like, no, like I don't, how are we protecting our brains?
So unfortunately, you know, once it's in, you could get, for example, if you're not getting signals, that could be because there's a lot of inflammation that is preventing the electrodes to get readouts. And that could be like, hey, we need to check. But I think once it's in, to my knowledge at least, there's no like a way for us to really be checking that everything is going well. Now, because these things are connected, there are certain parameters that potentially, you know, you could again assess to see these things. But something that I did want to mention as well was with the current patient with Neuralink a few days ago, it was reported that some of the threads have retracted. And I mean, that is not the end of the game, right? What they did was they tweaked the algorithm so that with less data coming in, the system could still have the same type of output. I think because the algorithm had already learned enough, they kind of managed to keep him within the same level of performance. But that shows that these, you know, technologies are, you know, can fail, can break, and and fortunately in this case, enough threads were still available for them to make it to still perform. But yeah, what happens if, you know, how many threads you really need for the system to work, and what does that mean to have those threads in your brain? Kind of there, right?
And over time, what does that look like? What is the upkeep on this? Because again, each time you go in, you're opening, like, brain surgery, head surgery is serious business. Like, we should not be entering into it lightly. And so, yeah, I think that, like, right now, sort of like with the birth of, you know, the semaglutides, which, like, stimulate the pancreas, it's starting with some really good intentions to solve some really important medical problems. But what are sort of the sort of, like, off-prescription applications of what this can do? What are some sort of those, how is it, I'm always worried of like, how is this going to enter into like pop culture in some frustrating way?
Yeah. You know, I mean, it's interesting because again, most medical companies would, they're very cautious in keeping their claims. Like, we want to help, you know, cure or mitigate, you know, things from certain brain disorders, right? But in the case of Neuralink, they're one of the companies that have been very much outspoken about, I think there's a quote from Elon Musk that says something like, you know, brain implants for the masses, right? So it's not just about, they want to start with disorders, but they haven't been shy about saying everyone can have a link, and they can, you know, instead of typing an email, they can just think about it and send it. And so they already start playing with these thoughts about it doesn't need to be used for medical purposes. Yeah. But you're right, having brain surgery is not a matter that we should take this like, you know, it's not just like any other medical procedure. And yet they wanna build a story about like, oh, you have this brain robot, it's like, it's not as risky as any other brain surgery. I don't know, some people are excited,
sure,
but a lot of people are scared.
In another episode where we talked about sort of CRISPR technology, I talked about what does the incorporation of this technology mean for like the future of humanity? And I think that this technology, I'm like, are we creating a two-tier society or a multi-tier society, right? Of like, folks who can't afford anything, folks that can afford the highest level. And then are we going to have a lot of sort of like middle stages in here? Are we just creating a new caste system that really just doubles down and reinforces that, like, if you have more money, you've got a better brain computer interface, and we're just reinforcing the same problems that we've always had, right? What does it mean for the future of problem solving? I have concerns about what it does for equity, but I also have concerns about, are we creating a situation where we are no longer humans anymore? Are we becoming, because it feels very like Blade Runner to me.
I mean, all of these discussions, I mean, yes, all of these issues are so interesting. That's what I love, the field of neuroethics, right? Let's start with the last one that you mentioned, which is like, are we still human? And that's a question that, you know, we can really even think without using brain implants. Like, you know, how many things we already do that humans 200 years ago would be very unnatural, right? And so that boundary of what makes us humans, what doesn't, like someone with xenotransplantation, is human? Is it a hybrid now? And then the field of cyborgs has been like, you know, if I have a robotic arm because, you know, I lost my limb, am I fully human? And so that question of what makes us human has been an ongoing thing. And the more we have capabilities to get to the brain, which seems to be like the organ that most people associate with, not necessarily with humanness, but at least with the self or with, you know, or the organ that orchestrates
identity,
that we're, exactly, identity or, so I think those questions have arisen with more kind of power.
Yeah.
Like, are we losing something? Because now that organ that used to be the center for identity, agency, autonomy, now we have this other system that could potentially override, and we wouldn't even notice, right? Because you have it there so seamlessly, and science fiction has touched with some of these issues, right? Like where the AI, and I'm making quotation marks, takes over the human part. And would we even notice?
Yeah.
And so these are, I find, very fascinating questions. But I think at the moment, the equity question is also very interesting. But at the moment, we really need to prove that this works, right? Mm-hmm. And the equity questions, we already seen with less invasive technologies. I mean, there's equity questions of how people get access to deep brain stimulation, mm-hmm. but also how people get access to just seeing a psychiatrist, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not downplaying the issue. I'm just saying there's so many things where equity is a priority and we have mm-hmm. so much work to do. And one of the key areas when I've, you know, talk about this is, why are we investing so much money in developing these systems where really, I mean, it's good that we can help this population, mm-hmm. but there we can do so much more for a majority of people if we kind of think differently about these priorities with technology.
Yeah, you know, sort of, again, sort of jumping back to this conversation that we had about CRISPR-Cas9, you know, one of the big things was they're like, hey, we're pretty sure that we've sort of solved sickle cell anemia, but it's going to cost several million dollars per person to go through this process. And it's like, well, who is this for?
Mm-hmm.
Right? You've created a solution to a problem that can't be implemented, right? And that's, I think, like a concerning piece of this is that, like, yeah, the technology is new. It's inevitably going to be more expensive now than if they ever figure out how to mass produce it. But, like, we know our healthcare system is expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Having a baby costs tens of thousands of dollars,
mm-hmm.
and brain surgery is on a completely different level. Who is affording that? Like, what insurance company is going to take on and say, yeah, I'll cover it? That's not happening.
Yeah.
Also, for our listeners, in the event that you hear it, there is a thunderstorm currently, and the only part of the studio that does not have soundproofing is the window. So you may get a little bit of thunder and rumblies, but it's fine. We're fine. Everything's safe.
You know, one of the things that I think is also very interesting is, you know, because you talk about like these, like the haves and the have-nots. And then one of the questions that I've been really puzzled by is, will these people really want to be the first adopters? Because, you know, being a first adopter of technologies such as the one we've been discussing is, there's a lot of troubleshoot that needs to happen. And do they really want to be the first ones to be messing with their brains?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't think that the people with they're going to be those sort of, oh gosh, it's the stage after early adopters, right? Because early adopters, in these sorts of things, I think that there's a sense of desperation or like, I have tried everything else. I'm willing to try this very wild alternative. If I'm just like trying to have one so that I like can like change the channels on my TV without having to use a remote or like scroll through Instagram and TikTok without using my finger, like, I just don't know that I would see myself, even with buckets and buckets of money, being like, yeah, let's try it.
Yeah, and I think those type of things is what puts into question, I mean, I don't know if our humanity, but at least certainly crucial about our society,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, how much we value even relationships, right? Like, if we can just, we hear a lot about people having these relationships with AI bots and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
How much do we value to have conversations face to face with other human? How much do we value being able to interact with our environments where, you know, it's not, I don't have to move. I don't know if for our audience, if you have watched the movie WALL-E, where at the end of the day, they're just sitting in this thing and they're all, you know, overweight because they don't move and they don't know how to do things.
Yeah, they can get food and drinks on demand. An advertisement tells them what to switch to and they do it because, well, it's easier, right? And so, you know, I think the obvious sort of things that we fear with this technology is that someone will hack it and actively take over. I'm as equally concerned about the more nefarious sort of like subtle things,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, can they make me visually pick up the color red more and focus on it more so that when a commercial for Coca-Cola mm-hmm. or if I'm shopping in the store and I see products with red packaging, then I'm more likely to buy them because I'm getting a stimulation out of it, right? How do we choose where the lines are,
mm-hmm.
right? Which is why I'm really glad that there are people like you who are studying the science but also have this emphasis in okay, we can do this, but why are we doing this? And what boundaries do we need to put in place? Because it's terrifying what this type of technology can do without boundaries.
Correct. And I think one of the reasons why, you know, Neuralink has gotten so much of a, time in the air is because, as I mentioned, there's other companies that have been doing it for decades, right? There's people that have been developing BCI. But really now you have this person that is this public figure that tends to be very controversial and being much out there. And so now there's much coverage on these topics.
Yeah.
Which on the one hand is a good thing because people now are at least starting to like, oh, BCI, what is that? And then you're learning a little bit about it. But at the same time, it is also a concern because there's someone that has, for some people think he's great and will follow. And if he says this is like the next thing, they probably will do what they can to get one, right?
Yeah.
And on the other hand, there's the skeptics that are like, oh, no, I don't want to be involved with anything that this person is involved with because we see how... But maybe we shouldn't.
Won't go into conversations on personalities. We've all read the news.
And so, you know, like, I think the point that you make about how would these be used to more easily make us do things that already, you know, through social media, we are being told, like, what to do next in a way. And I wouldn't need a brand new.
There's algorithms out there. This is an algorithm that is designed to create a response in us, right? Doesn't always work, but it works quite often. That's why they work. This is something in our brain telling us that it is working. It's not even a matter of like us being able to say like, I understand what's happening here cognitively with what's happening in social media, and I'm going to say no to this. This is something in our brain saying, yep, go ahead.
Yeah, you won't have that. Like some of my colleagues like to think, like even with social media, you still in theory have the power to not act on it. But if you directly stimulate the brain to have a certain preference, you cannot do an override to that, right?
Yeah.
Because they're going directly to the source that creates that agency on or decision making.
Yeah, and you know, I feel like, again, not to sort of like dive into the turbulent waters of politics, but we really don't, there are certain politicians that really don't love regulation, and there are some things that need to be very regulated, and I feel like this is one of those things that really needs to fall under that umbrella of like, we need to have very strict rules. How do we create checks and balances? Who's checking it? How are they checking it? Because like, this is like science and computers and programming and technology in levels that would be have been unimaginable even to those people that were early sort of like investigators of this science 15 years ago, right? I think about where I was 15 years ago. I had so much more hair on my head. But I never would have imagined that this would be something I would see in my lifetime. And there are people walking around on the streets that have it. And what is it? So I'm wrestling with these ideas way sooner than I thought I would. I thought I would have no hair left before I'd have to start wrestling with these topics. What are, when you think about it, what are the questions that you hope we answer? And who do you think should be involved in helping to answer those questions? That's a huge question.
So I think on the one hand, this is, you know, it is a multi-sectorial conversation, right?
Yeah.
So it cannot only be left to the engineers and scientists, and also cannot just be left to the politician. It requires conversations across all of these people and primarily also the potential users, right? So what are the expectations for this technology? What are their fears? And how can we co-design together? And co-design is not just a technology, but also co-design the guardrails all these technologies.
I just had like a random sort of like connected thought. You know, we have advanced directives, right? These are what I would like to have happen if I'm in these sorts of states in my future, right? If I'm in a persistent vegetative state, this is what I sort of want to have happen to me, right? If I am going to have major, if like I'm going to pass, this is what I want to have done with my organs, my body, whatever. And I think that's a really important thing that we have and that it's legally enforceable. And so I'm wondering if there is sort of a version of an advanced directive around like, I give, in like these sorts of circumstances, I give permission for this technology to work in this way. I don't give it permission to work in these sorts of ways.
I mean, it'd be interesting, right? That we could sign such a thing.
Right.
But I think it also comes to a matter of trust. At least I'll tell you that if I have signed this, I don't know that I still trust the companies that will abide to it. And this is just, you know, maybe there's just me, but I feel like unfortunately these big corporations, even the government, have made us lose trust.
Yeah.
And in matters of such delicate nature, I just don't know that even signing I will, you know, fully trust and want to have that even on me.
Yeah. It seems also like I think about like who is in charge of sort of enforcing that, right? It's sort of an external party to the group, right? Because if we think about it within the context of medicine, the enforcing group is sort of like our legal system, which is sort of external to that. But this is just so much more, it's just complex on a whole different planet. And so I'm just like, how do we solve a problem like this when it can so easily go above so many people's heads?
Yeah.
Of what is actually practically happening. And man, if you want to make something sound good, all you got to do is pick around the data and you'll find something that makes you sound good. And so there's a lot of money to be made.
Yes.
And I am so concerned about, we're so money driven in society and a lot of decisions get made around money. And our population in the United States is not growing, which is terrifying to some people, right? Because our economy is sort of built around continual growth. And the only way to do that is to have more people with more money all contributing to the economy. That's how it keeps growing, right? You can't create new money out of nowhere. And so if we can't create more people, we create new needs by communicating that, hey, you need this, you need to respond in this way. So I wish there was a way to detether money from this, but I don't see how that happens.
Yeah. And I think, you know, one of the things that make me think again, because I've been aiming to say this before, was, you know, even if we say we need a system of regulation, is the current one, it is, I'm going to say unfair, because on the one hand you have, you know, let's say if you are an academic or a researcher in an academic institution and you have to, you know, when you have this type of research, you have to build your protocol, you have to post it in clinicaltrials.org, you know, you have to constantly get reports back to your funder and things like that. If you're in industry, like, those rules don't apply to you.
Yeah.
And I think in these particular cases with this type of technologies, it shouldn't matter if you're industry or if you're an academic center. But when we're talking about the money issue, unfortunately, and I think this is not, you know, news, a lot of our government is very industry driven, right? Like it's a lot of these decisions are based on what corporations and industry can benefit.
Yeah. Like, this is cool what you're telling me, right? But where is it? What's in it for me, right? Who's going to pay for something that's not going to have like a huge financial payoff? Very few people, maybe Dolly Parton.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you know, we don't have many people with very deep pockets that are thinking about the collective good of society if it doesn't benefit them in some way. And like, I grew up with very little. I'm fine now, right? it's easy for me to say, like, yeah, of course I'd do that, but I've also never had $1 million. So I don't know what I'd do with $1 million if I had it. Would I be like, yeah, I'll invest in it for sure, buy money? Or would I be like, what's in it for me? I don't know. I've never had $1 million.
Yeah, hopefully it would be nice if everyone could
have the ability to decide what they would do with $1 million.
Right.
I wish. So for the students out there that are thinking about going into healthcare, what are the questions that you hope they're asking themselves about this? Because so much of this relies on the expertise of medical professionals, right? That robot was not designed without consultation of someone who can do surgery, right? What are the questions that you're hoping our future healthcare providers ask themselves about this technology?
Yeah, well, I guess not just Neuralink, but to any technology that you use as a medical provider, is like, do we really need it?
Yeah.
That's step one, right? Like, does it really solve a need for me and my patients? Or mm-hmm. is this just something that is pushed from, you know,
yeah,
up in the change of leadership for me to use?
Yeah.
You know, something that keeps surprising me is there was in one of the engineering magazines, there was this report about how we're developing these very cool robotic arms that are like, you know, I don't know if people have heard of the Luke arm, which really looks like a very cool Star Wars, you know, arm. It looked like a real hand, and yeah, it has a lot of different, you know, movements that it can do. And it costs a lot, of course.
Of course it does.
And then a lot of these people that require hand prosthesis, they are like, well, first, who can afford it? And second, even if we can afford it, it is so expensive that we don't want to use it in our daily lives because I'm afraid that I will break it and then what would I have? So again, this might be go more for those developing, but even those for those that are, you know, not providing, but referring people to these mm-hmm. technologies, is to ask, you know, how would my patient really engage with this technology? Do they really benefit from engaging with this technology? In the case of deep brain stimulation, for example, because this is, you know, something that has been already around, I mean, there are patients that might not be ready for it. There might mm-hmm. be patients that are too keen to have it. Providers have to say, hey, you're not ready yet. So I think as a provider, you have that responsibility of really, you know, kind of, I don't want to say be the gatekeeper, because I think it should be a conversation with the patient, mm-hmm. but really provide balanced information that don't get sold on the hype of technology, because sometimes technology don't solve the problems that we wanted to get.
Yeah, it causes new ones.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, I think a pretty decent example of this is within the deaf community, sort of the conversation around cochlear implants. Who is that technology for? Is it for the individual or is it for the people around them, right? Because the deaf community has a really rich culture. It has like a really supportive, you know, community. By pulling them out of that community in some way, what are you leaving them with, right? And what is that technology beneficial to them? Is it causing them pain but helping them be more palatable to the people around them? You know, that's like sort of the immediate parallel that jumped to my brain.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause that technology is not perfect. It sounds like a miracle technology, right? But it works for some folks, and for a lot of people, they're like, I might have it on for an hour a day now that I've had it for a while because it's just too much.
Mm-hmm.
And we are stimulated by so much in the day. You know, I think about how different my life was in my early 20s. And I am not going to tell the listeners how long ago that was. But I think about it and I was like, I would go days without looking at my phone's text messages because I didn't think about it. Because I didn't care. And because I wasn't like built around that. Now I have a phone that I check maybe once every half hour, if not more than that, just to see what, like, if I have missed anything. I have a watch on my wrist that tells me if I've gotten anything. I just think about how differently my life has been. And it's been a very short period of time. And what does this new level of interface and stimulation look like? Can we turn this off?
Mm-hmm.
Can I take a break? Can I just be like, I think I'm done for a bit. Like, where do we get to press stop?
Yeah, I mean, certainly this is something that within different communities we've been trying to advocate for, that the user has that possibility.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously it varies across disorders, right? Like if you are someone that, you know, that, I mean, you want to be typing, you want to be engaging, maybe you don't need to have the technology on when you're sleeping, so you can turn it off.
Yeah.
And people have been trying to develop more and more this type of interfaces where the user can have some control for certain things. I mean, one has to also be careful because sometimes users can also, you know, want to experiment. And so you also have to build guardrails around the type of things that they can do versus things that they cannot do. But that's what makes the field as a whole so interesting and messy at the same time, because there's so many considerations from so many different perspectives that need to be accounted for.
So if I'm a student listening or an alum, and actually we have listeners from around the world, but let's say I'm listening and I'm like, wow, this is really interesting, but I want to know more. Where might you direct someone who wants to learn more about this type of technology? Are there particular researchers, particular schools that you feel are perhaps more experts in this thing, journals? Where would you send somebody?
Well, there's two major neuroethics journals where, I mean, some of these gets published, you know, in a continuous basis. So that would be Neuroethics, that's the name of the journal. And then the other one is Age of Neuroscience.
Okay.
And then if you really want to get into the more technical details, you know, there's many journals that cater for that more, you know, tech savvy audience. And I'm not a big X user, but I know that there's a couple of good accounts to follow. I think his name is Kip. No, I'm not going to remember his name. But there's a couple of people that are really bringing balance to the conversation.
Okay.
And so... So, yeah, I think I generally do read X this. So, yeah, if people are interested, you know, you're more than welcome to follow me or at least see the things I tweet. I tend to work around.
Yeah, if people want to find you, where can they find you? Where are you on the interwebs?
So I'm on X. I think my handle is Nero Ed Cabrera, like Nero Ed underscore Cabrera.
Gotcha.
And LinkedIn, you can find me as Laura Y. Cabrera.
Okay.
I also, you can find me in my webpage in the Penn State site is a Neuroethics Lab.
Okay.
And I would also suggest people that are interested in this intersection, the IEEE, which is one of the largest organizations around technology. We're working with both, well, one, creating a framework around neuroethics on different applications, where BCIS is one, and we touch on medical, but we also touch on what are the ethical issues around using these technologies for military purposes.
Ooh.
Or for workplace.
Wow.
Or for education. So, you know, again, we tend to focus on the one, and this makes sense because it's a pre-med type of, but there's so many other areas where these technologies are being developed for that raise other type of considerations. And then IEEE standards, we're working on developing a standard on responsible neurotechnology, where we really want to, you know, create some guidelines around or some recommendations around how to develop, how to engage different, you know, perspectives so that developers and people using the technology, so like physicians and so, know better how to engage with these technologies.
I really want to thank you for your time. This has been like really fascinating. I had not put like a ton of thought into this particular technology. And again, just because I understood it so little. But this has been really, really fascinating, terrifying, but I think a little bit inspiring as well. I think the technology in the right hands, with the right guardrails, with the right intention and sort of interdisciplinary input, there is a lot of power in what it can do. And so I very much see why you were like, oh, this is cool stuff. I need to get into this. I just really want to thank you for your time.
No, my pleasure.
All right. So to our listeners, thank you for joining us this week, and we'll see you next week on the Pre-Health Podcast at Penn State. The Pre-Health Podcast at Penn State is a production of the Pre-Health Advising Office and the Everly College of Science at Penn State. It is produced, edited, and promoted by the Pre-Health Advising Team. The views, opinions, and advice shared during this podcast are that of the hosts and any guests only, and do not necessarily reflect the best advice for every student at every institution or for every health profession. This is a nonprofit podcast made for the purpose of better serving pre-health students across our university system. Our intro music is This Science from Coma Media, and our outro music is Screening, also by Coma Media. Thank you.